Welcome to season two of Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources consultant in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Ford Keast LLP, providing human resources advice and counsel to my business clients. I also support people through individual one-on-one coaching in helping with career development. I hope you will enjoy our series where we talk with ordinary, extraordinary people. We get to hear about interesting journeys. We get to talk with people about failures, successes, advice, and counsel to us as we develop our own careers. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with these people, and I hope you will enjoy listening to it. And now for some logistics. Please subscribe on YouTube, or if you're a listener, please follow me wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a chance, I hope you'll visit my website, career-resilience.com. Welcome. My guest today is Rob Austin. Rob, welcome to Career Resilience.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to chat with you today. And we're going to talk about career resilience because that's what this is all about. So we're going to chat a bit about your career resilience and your career. We also want to talk about neurodiversity, which is an area of interest and study for you. And I think that's going to be really fascinating in terms of talent for organization. And so I'm excited to get into that too. I'd like to start though with sort of getting a thumbnail view of your career, because it's very varied. And I wonder if you could just sort of sum it up a little bit for us.
Yeah, I trained as a mechanical engineer. Although at the same time, I was studying English literature. So my university degrees are in English literature and mechanical engineering, which is kind of an odd combination. I think that, a recruiter once told me it looked like the printer had malfunctioned and combined two people's CVs as he was looking at my CV. And that I would say that also has projected into the rest of my life and career, that some people would say it's varied. Some people would say it's unfocused, depending on whether which way you were inclined to think about it. But anyway, I went to work. I decided I was going to go to playwriting school. So I went to playwriting school with a mechanical engineering degree and had a great time at that. But it became apparent to me that people in the playwriting program, they either were becoming playwrights and not very many were becoming playwrights, or there was really no other career prospect for them. And my father couldn't believe that I'd, turned down engineering jobs to go to playwriting school. And kind of with him whispering over my shoulder, I eventually took a job at the Ford Motor Company in computer related activities. So spent over 10 years at the Ford Motor Company as a computer guy. And my wife at the time decided she wanted to get a PhD and study with a particular professor who was in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon. And so I went along with her, didn't have much to do there. So I joined the PhD program too. And that's how I became a PhD. I never saw myself as an academic. I went back to Ford after I got my PhD. That's what I had planned to do and what I intended to do. I was pretty happy there. But then through a weird set of circumstances, a friend of mine applied for a job at Harvard Business School. And he didn't get the job, but he referred them to me. And they ended up making me an offer for a position that I wasn't actually looking for, which I turned down the first time because I was having such a good time working for Ford, living in Europe at the time. And but ultimately, Harvard prevailed upon me. They said, if you don't like working for us, we'll make sure you go back into your career at Ford at a higher level than you left. And because a lot of the alums at Ford you know, a lot of Harvard alums at Ford, I believe them. I believe they could do that. But anyway, that was my entree into academia. And very shortly after I made that transition, Ford hit a very bad period. And so I was not tempted to go back to Ford. Most of my friends were leaving. And so I spent, you know, I spent 12 years at Harvard, although I did take a detour to go work at a startup company that was the brainchild of a guy named Eric Schmidt, who went on to become the chairman of Google. And so that was an interesting experience. And I also spent some time during that 12 and a half years on sabbatical, basically at Copenhagen Business School, which was the next place that I went. So, and that was again about my wife's career. She had a great opportunity to go to Copenhagen Business School. And so we went there for a while. At one point, we had complicated visa situations in Denmark because we were had our own work permits. In the mix of all of that, we ended up having to leave Denmark. So we came back to North America. I became the dean of the Faculty of Business at the University of New Brunswick. But then her career remained at Copenhagen Business School. And so she was kind of flying back and forth. Ultimately, we went back to Copenhagen. It's always very difficult for two academic family to find employment in the same geography. And so we struggled with that a lot and ultimately ended up coming back and both getting jobs at Ivy. So I don't know if that was the short version, but it's kind of a convoluted path, honestly.
It is. I'm going to ask you, so when you were growing up, and, you know, I'm always interested in this, when somebody would say to you, what do you want to be when you grow up, Rob? Would you say, I want to be a playwright?
No, I knew I was interested in literature. Mm. But, you know, I don't know that I had a good answer for that when I was growing up. Mm. I know one of the things I very distinctly remember is watching an old animated TV show called Johnny Quest. And Johnny Quest was this like world adventurer who went around the world. He was a kid like me, right? But he went around the world with his father, Dr. Quest, who was some sort of PhD. And apparently people tell me as a little kid, I said, I want to be a doctor like Dr. Quest. He's not a medical doctor. He's a doctor of everything else. This is what I thought, right? Yeah. That's the only thing I ever remember saying or being told that I said about what I wanted to be when I grew up.
What do you think it is about you that you're open to that kind of adventure in terms of, yeah, we'll go to Copenhagen, we'll go to New Brunswick, we'll go to London, Ontario. What is it about you that you had that comfort? Because a lot of people don't have that thought about being able to do those things.
Yeah, I think it's a couple things. I mean, one, you know, I had a roommate in college who knew he wanted to be a partner in a law firm, I think, when he was 6 years old. And today he's a very successful partner in a law firm in the Boston area. But I just never had that, right? I've always had, you know, I mentioned before that people thought my academic interests in university were unfocused, right? I mean, I was studying engineering, I was studying English literature, and I was doing a lot of playwriting. I think I've just never, I've always been too interested in things, right? I think in many ways, the wandering reflects the variety and intensity of my interests. One thing it definitely doesn't reflect, I would say, is a optimized path to, you know, success by any particular criteria. Although I'm not complaining, I think I've done fine. But if you were trying to optimize, you know, take the shortest path to monetary success or academic success or whatever that might be, or whatever you might be aiming for, I don't think that wandering approach that I've taken would be the one I would recommend.
I see what you mean.
Although I don't regret it at all.
No, it's very eclectic, and eclectic is great. Of course, I should ask you, did you ever sell a play or...
So I've had a couple of plays. This is all the way back when I was in playwriting school. I had two plays produced. One was produced at a kind of an artsy cafe. Mm-hmm. And this was in Austin, Texas. So I was going to school at the University of Texas. I was in a Master of Fine Arts program there. And it was a one-act play, a single actor. It was a monologue that was done at a little artsy cafe. And then the University of Texas had what they called a studio theater, where they produced some of the playwriting students' work. And so that was produced for an audience. But other than that, I've had other literary works that I've sold, books and so forth. But and I have this fantasy every once in a while that I might get back to writing plays when I retire or sometime anyway.
Yeah. I don't see why not. It would be completely consistent with your career.
I think I might like to try that. You wonder if maybe I've waited a bit too late, right?
So let's just switch over then to resilience. What do you think in your career, how have you been resilient and how have you had to be resilient?
So I don't know. It's an interesting question. I don't think I've been through anything especially harrowing compared to some people who I know. I have had periods in my career where there were very intractable challenges that were facing me. So on one occasion, when I was in Denmark, I was the CEO of a private foundation for a while. It was kind of a dual path with my professorship there. And the chairman of the board was having a problem with the press. And anyway, kind of a long story, but I kind of got caught in the crossfire between the press and somebody they were after. It got really rough in the news. That was a very difficult time. It was a situation that was, I was waking up at 3 a.m. every day to Google Translate the Danish newspapers to see whether I was in them, right? And whether they were picking on something to do with this organization that I was running. I wasn't being personally blamed, but I was, I was kind of portrayed as one of this guy's flunkies, right? One of this guy's lieutenants or bad guys. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty tough situation. I mean, at one point I consulted lawyers to find out if they thought I was in any sort of legal consequence as a result of, all the craziness that was being dug up. They were actually accusing the guy I worked for, the chairman of the board, of an illegality informing the foundation that I was running. Oh. And so anyway, that was a pretty rough period. There was also a period, I mentioned that I was the dean of business at the University of New Brunswick. And one of the things I discovered my first day of work is that the guy who was my boss at UNB, his title was vice president academic. Most schools would call him the provost, but he had overruled the search committee and chosen me over an internal candidate. And so the very first day of work, I discovered that most of the people who worked for me preferred the other candidate and thought it was not right and unjust that I was showing up to be the dean. And so that was a pretty rough time, right? I had people showing up saying, I'm going to be a problem for you. I don't think it's right that you're in this office. I'm going to resist everything you try to do and so on. And so, I think, for example, in that case, my response was, I met with every single faculty member. I tried to understand what they were about and what I could do to help them realize their objectives. And I think it was a really tough, year and a half or so after I took that job. But I think over time, I largely you know, kind of won them over and got them aligned. And I think people thought things were going in a good direction. But that did definitely require some resilience. And I, it required a lot of stress and worry. Yeah. So I don't know what advice I would give about that, except to say that, you know, press on, put your head down and execute your plan. But I, the flip side of that, I would also point out though, is, you know, in the end, that position didn't work out very well either, because I was hired with a particular mission in mind, and later that mission became irrelevant. And it's kind of a long story again, but I was hired to do a particular thing that I was at some point realizing that I wasn't going to be able to do, that the leadership of the university had changed their mind about it. And at that point, I did not stick around very long, right? I mean, I suppose if someone who might have been super resilient might have said, oh, well, I'm going to keep pressing on. But I don't think I have always pressed on. I think sometimes I have moved on instead.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you can move on and have a new adventure and leave it that adventure to a great learning experience. Right. So.
No, I agree. But I wonder sometimes if I were advising other people, I might say, you know, when you're thinking about pressing on and what you're doing or moving on, have a little more bias than I have towards pressing on. I might have moved on too much, which, you know, for some people anyway, which has led to the sort of wandering profile that we talked about, right? Mm-hmm.
This eclectic profile, Rob.
Okay, I like that. And, you know, like I say, I don't regret it for a minute. I've found everything interesting, and I think I've realized the objectives that I had. But if you're, you know, what I didn't do is stay for 10 years and overcome all odds.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think that sometimes we do stay for 10 years because we say, need to put food on the table, need to survive here, all those kinds of things. And there's so many people that have stayed for 10 years when that's just a very sad thing to do when we only have this ticket once.
No, I agree. And, you know, that's one of the hardest things I think to figure out in my experience is when to move on and when to press on. And it's related to a question, and I've often given this advice to students, which is before you accept an opportunity, you should make sure you're convinced that it's winnable. Because in those two instances that I've talked about with you, I think ultimately my assessment in retrospect is that I took on jobs that were not winnable. And if I were to fault myself, it would be for not seeing that soon enough.
You know, I've never thought of it that way before. And I have certainly been in jobs that weren't winnable. And I like that thought process because it's the reality. So let's leave that job for someone else for whom it is winnable.
Yeah. And I think partly if you think that way, you may be more inclined than I've been to bargain for a little bit more latitude or a little bit more resource or something. You know, I mean, I think the kinds of situations we're talking about, they're the kinds of situations when people bring you in and they ask you to do something, but they don't give you the authority or the means or the resources that you really are going to require. To get it done. And I think that's actually quite common, right? That people are given a lot of responsibility, but not enough authority, or it's probably quite common. But, you know, and I'm not sure I've done a good job of this, but I think the right thing to do is at the beginning, bargain for the resources that you need to succeed.
Yeah.
You know, that's partly assessing what the resources are that you need to succeed, and partly kind of having the nerve to go back and put at risk this opportunity that you're seeing to say, I'm not going to take it unless you can give me more, you know, not more in terms of what I need personally, but what I need to get the job done.
Yeah, I like that. I did want to chat about your interest and your work on neurodiversity, because I think we talk a lot about diversity in terms of background, ethnicity, all those things. I'm not sure how much we talk about neurodiversity. So can you sort of speak to what that's all about?
Yeah, so neurodiversity, it's a word that was first used in the late 90s. It was coined by someone named Judy Singer, who was was an advocate for people on the autism spectrum. And the idea that she was getting at is that there are differences in the way we all think, right? We're all different neurologically, but there are some people who have neurological conditions, if you like, that end up being diagnosed. And historically, they were given medical definitions that were considered, disorders. I mean, literally, autism spectrum disorder, ASD, is characterized medically as a disorder. And neurodiversity kind of pushes back against that. It says, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just different. Right? And I'm personally, I'm not on the autism spectrum as far as I know, but I've never been diagnosed anyway. I do have a child who's neurodiverse, although not autistic. But the basic idea has gotten broader. It sounds like it's neurologically based. And some of the conditions that it describes are neurologically based, but I think they're not all neurologically based. It really just describes people who think differently and may come across differently in interpersonal relationships because of that. And it really just kind of says broadly, that's okay, right? We're all different. My particular research has been around employment.
Yes.
And the fact that it's very difficult for some people who are neurodivergent to get employed because they have a hard time with some of the rituals that we engage in employing people, right? Or specifically in recruiting people. And more specifically, people have trouble with interviews, right? People have trouble being interviewed. There's some incredibly qualified people in the world who just don't interview well. And, that's at the heart of the neurodiversity employment movement, that fact.
And so if they don't interview well, then what is the alternative when that sort of seems to be where we try and push them?
So a lot of the progress that's been made in the past, by now it's been about 15 years, 17 years. The company that started in this direction was a Danish company that was founded in 2004, Specialist Sterna. And what they did is they started to hire people not based on interviews, but based on something that looks more like tryouts, right? So they would bring people in and have them do exercises and project work, and usually over a longer period of time than an interview would take. So if an interview is, you talk about what you can do, these kinds of experiences where you show what you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it would take 3 or 4 days. This company, it's Specialist Sterna, means the specialists in Danish. They use Lego Mindstorms. So they had people kind of build robots and things out of Lego Mindstorms, and people would watch them work. And they discovered they could learn quite a lot. They could assess quite a lot about the capabilities of the person, even if they couldn't, persuasively in an interview explain those capabilities. And so, these kinds of practices have been what, now multinational companies are doing the same thing. SAP was a pioneer. They started their program in 2013. Microsoft, their program has been going since 2015. There are a whole bunch of others now. But all of them have in common, many of them were actually trained by Specialist Sterna, at least at the outset. And all of them have developed these alternatives to interview-based recruiting. And actually what's interesting is some of the techniques that they've developed are now migrating back to their mainstream recruiting. they're discovering that it's actually better to do tryouts with everyone. So that's becoming more common.
Are you talking a lot about tech type of businesses, or are they just sort of leading edge?
So a lot of it started in tech, I think. And I think it started in tech because it's very innovative in tech and they're always short of talent. Also in tech, you know, there's this intermediation by the technology, right? The computer. There's an old New Yorker cartoon that shows a dog sitting at a computer, and the caption under the cartoon says, "The great thing about the internet is that on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." Right. And so I think one of the things that the internet has done is it's placed neurodivergent people and non-neurodivergent people, are you know, less neurodivergent people, because it's not a dichotomy, on the same basis, right? Because when we're communicating via text or email or whatever, all the social cues are stripped away anyway. Mm-hmm. And so none of us really have the social cues. The difficulties an autistic person might have with social nuance or sarcasm or irony, we all have that problem with email, right? And also people can work from afar and work effectively and so forth. And that's been a tradition in the tech industry. But more recently, it's branched out well beyond the tech industry. So one of the biggest programs today is JPMorgan Chase, which is banking. But there are many others. We've been researching at Ivy, entry-level positions in small manufacturing companies in the Midwest, in the U.S. And these are by no means high-tech firms.
Mm-hmm. And so let's take that as an example. I want to apply to a small firm in the Midwest. What would you do with me that was different from the sort of regular interview that I would expect?
Yeah, I think it's a similar theme, right? That they have come up with ways of assessing what people can do by watching them work, as opposed to just talking to them about the job. And what we're seeing in a lot of these for the entry level positions in, you know, sort of lower skill level job requirement positions is typically they'll take people to the job, say on the assembly line, that they're going to ask them to do, and they'll kind of explain it and they'll watch them do it for a while. Right. And, you know, sometimes they're really good at it. I mean, there's some other reasons to do it in place, which is, one of the characteristics of people who are neurodivergent is that they sometimes have trouble with too much auditory stimulus, or, you know, very noisy environments, or very busy environments, or environments where the lights flicker. That's another reason it's important to see someone work in place, because it could be that they just don't want to work there or can't tolerate the noise. Yeah. or something like that.
So what about, Rob, where soft skills come in, and you know how we have to work on a team and there's certain expectations of team members and that whole people interaction?
Yeah, those are issues that have to be managed in neurodiversity employment programs. One of the things that's a common feature in neurodiversity employment programs is training not only for the candidates, because there are it's very common to train the candidates in soft skills, but also for supervisors. And supervisors are really important in these programs because they end up doing coaching along these lines. So there's a lot of actually, you know, in retrospect, kind of amusing examples of situations where someone who didn't have soft skills, there's one story about a neurodivergent person who was working in a client company and turned to one of the client people and said, "You realize you really stink at your job. You're really not good at it." And that wasn't taken very well. And that was an opportunity for coaching, right? But it was fine. In the end, okay, I get it. I shouldn't say that. And so there are some additional supervisory challenges, I think, that these programs generate. Yeah. But I think they're quite manageable is what we're seeing there.
Is it a tough sell?
In some companies, it's a tough sell. Some companies worry about whether there will be too much cost associated with it. Mm. You know, typically, one of the features of these programs is that they, you know, they offer accommodations, is the phrase that's usually used. Sure. So could be soundproof headphones, or, you know, maybe you've got to change the lights because there are fluorescent lights that flicker at a bad frequency or whatever. So there are some costs, but there's a lot of studies that show that we already accommodate people, and the costs of accommodating neurodivergent people are really not very much different than what we're already doing. Yeah. So there's costs. Sometimes there's legal concerns about, you know, legal liability if something doesn't work out, right? You know, some companies have veered away from it. But I think, you know, the companies that are trying it are showing it's, you know, I'm a business school professor, right? And I know I work with companies, and companies, they want to see proof that you can do it, right? They don't want to be the pioneer necessarily. But I think there are some pioneering firms that have been willing to try it and be the proof statement for other companies. And that's been successful enough that there's a lot of companies that now believe we can do it.
Yeah. I think that we're somewhat intimidated by the diversity of others, and neurodiversity would fall into that. And, you know, actually on a previous episode, I talked with someone who's dyslexic and the challenges of that for him and his, well, in particular, his growing up before he was diagnosed, but just in terms of sort of being on the sort of regular path that everybody else is on. Mm-hmm. And yet you can also see the drive that this has given him. Right? Because sometimes not having an easy path is almost better.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely something to that. When people, I mean, the way I usually explain the difficulties that neurodivergent people have in the world. So like in, you know, context of a conversation that I have sometimes is, neurodivergent people in business school, what's it like for them, right? And we talk about this in our teaching and learning committees and so forth. And I said, imagine going through the world, through a world that is optimized for other people, but not for you. Mm-hmm. And so frequently people who are dyslexic or autistic or whatever, they have to come up with compensating strategies. Mm-hmm. I mean, dyslexia is a great example because you don't stop being dyslexic, right? You just figure out other ways of sorting through things. And we did an experiment when I was a professor at Harvard where we, 1 year for an executive program, we provided audio versions of the readings. And we were about pretty much 80% of the way through the program. And I was finishing up lunch during one of the days of the program. And this gentleman who was in the program sat down next to me. He was an executive with a government organization. And he said, I just want to tell you, I want to thank you so much for providing the audio versions of this stuff. He said, because, you know, I don't tell people this much, but I'm dyslexic. And, you know, I went through my entire career with, you know, my mother reading books to me and things like that. And he said, you know, I still have this issue, but I've come up with a whole bunch of compensating strategies. And he told the story about a 10th grade a teacher that he had who, you know, took him aside and said, you know what, you can do anything that anybody else can do, but you're going to have to figure out your own way to do it, because you've got this issue and it's not going to go away in the world. You know, is it going to come to you necessarily? But yeah, I think, you know, he was a great example that he had that drive. He had pushed through. He had not been discouraged. Mm-hmm. And it served him well. That drive had probably served him in a lot of other ways.
Yeah. So do you feel, Rob, that we've come such a long way? Because I look back and I don't know why I was thinking of this as you were speaking, but one of my brothers was left-handed and there was just no question that he had to be right-handed. And so he was, you know, went through life neither right or left-handed in terms of writing. And so do you feel that we've made incredible progress in these kinds of situations and accepting each other?
I think we're making progress. I think you said earlier that people, you know, we're kind of intimidated by differences in others, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, mm-hmm. that there's a sense in which, you know, we're put off by people who seem to have not the characteristics or not made the decisions we have or whatever. You know, it's a little bit of a reproach to us if someone else has faced similar things and done it differently or whatever. But I do think we're making progress in this. And I think one of the things that's helping is, you know, in the way I usually like to put it is in the industrial world, it was very efficient. It was very important that everything was efficient, that all the gears, they kind of had to mesh, right? And there was no room for difference because difference was friction and friction was a failure of efficiency. And so if you're competing in the world, you know, if nations and companies are competing based on efficiency, then fitting in is a priority. But I think that's less and less true now, right? I think that companies and nations now compete on innovation. And I think with innovation, it's more important that people don't fit, right? So I used to say, you know, when I was at Ford, we used to say, you know, if a car rolls off the assembly line and it surprises us, that's not a good thing, right? A surprise when it rolls off the assembly line, that's called a quality problem, right? But in an innovation economy, if we're designing a new product, or if we're designing a new look or a brand or whatever, if it's not surprising in some way, if it's the same old thing, then that's a problem, right? And so the priorities have shifted, and I think more and more people are understanding that to really come up with things that are original and valuable, mm-hmm. which is the definition really of a creative or an innovative product or service, has to be original and valuable. We've got to have people who see things from different perspectives. And
yeah, here's something I've always wondered about. And since I have the opportunity to chat with you, is I've often thought about this, that let's say five people go into a meeting and there's a problem they need to solve, and not one of them has the answer to the problem, but together they get the problem solved. And I think if none of them have the answer to the problem, how does it get solved, Rob?
Yeah. Where did they come from? Where did the answer come from? No, it's a good thought experiment. Yeah. I think where it comes from is that, you know, they build on each other's ideas, right? And they create new ideas out of the combinations of what they brought into the room. Mm-hmm. And those combination ideas are original and valuable. Not always, but, you know, one of the things, it's related to your question. There are, one of the reasons crowdsourcing has become a big deal is, you know, a lot of crowdsourcing works best in situations like the one you described, where we've assembled our own team and we can't figure it out. So then the question arises, how do we get other perspectives on it? And crowdsourcing, one way of thinking about crowdsourcing is it's an inexpensive way to get other perspectives on problems that we can't solve with the people we have in the room.
That's interesting. Yeah. Which is another way to solve the problem.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's a relative of hiring people who are neurodivergent, right? Well, which is exactly. Just another way of getting different perspectives into the room.
Yeah. And I like that. It's true. It's a relative of that because of all these fascinating perspectives that we do bring, all of us. And the more you open the door to neurodiversity, the more you can be innovative and come up with ideas that you never would have thought of. So it's actually very exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I do think it's very exciting. And, you know, one of the things I know about myself is I am excited by difference and I am excited by originality and so forth. Not everyone may be as much that way, but yeah, I think in the final analysis, it's exciting because it's, you know, it's progress and it results in new and valuable things.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to just switch over to the three questions that I'm asking everybody. And the first one is, what is a book that you have read that you thought was really valuable to you in your career or to your life or whatever comes to mind?
Yeah, I don't usually find that business books, it's funny, right? I'm a business school professor, but I don't find that business books are the ones that inspire me the most. So if I were to say, you know, what book or books have been the most important to me in my career, I would tend to wander into the world of literature. And, if I think about the books that have had the biggest impact on me, probably one of the first and one of the longest lasting is Robert Penn Warren's book, All the King's Men, which, it's kind of based in the South. It's based in the world I come from. And it's a story about the way people are, right? And, you know, both good and bad. It's kind of an epic story about the rise of a charismatic politician from Louisiana. His name is Willie Stark in the book, but it's modeled on Huey Long, a lot of people think, who was a historic figure. Yeah. But that was an important book for me. Faulkner's book, Absalom, was important for me, partly because I related to some of the characters. And Absalom, one of the characters is from the Deep South and goes away to Harvard and is a student at Harvard and feels like he's out of place, which was something I related to very much. I mean, I left the South and went to not Harvard, but Swarthmore, which was, you know, one of the top three liberal arts colleges in the U.S. and, very kind of highbrow academic and, felt rather out of place. I ultimately worked at Harvard for 12 years. And, even then I used to say, I feel like I'm a barbecue guy in a caviar world. So I don't know, the books that helped me think about my feelings of being different or being out of, ultimately I think I like this feeling of being out of my element. Mm-hmm. And, trying to discover a new element. But I think those books helped me figure some of that out.
Yeah. Yeah. I can sort of see how those books fed into your actual career moves too. Yeah, absolutely. So the second question is, what is the best career advice you've received? I can't wait to hear this, Rob. This is going to be just fascinating.
The best career advice I've ever received, it probably came from most of the best career advice I've ever gotten comes from a guy named Dick Nolan, who has been a mentor to me. He was a professor at Harvard, and I still am still co-authoring with him. He and I are working on a book together right now. And what he used to say sometimes when I'd be exasperated with the way things were and kind of complaining to him was he'd say the world is wide and life is short, so you should just get on with whatever you're doing, right? Quit worrying about all this stuff and go do what you think is important. And that has been important advice for me at times, to sort of not get distracted by the little stuff. A version of that, one of my dissertation committee members, when I was a young professor at Harvard, I was back at Carnegie Mellon where I got my PhD, and it was Robin Dawes. And Robin, I was complaining to him about the difficulties of being a junior faculty member and the long hours and all the stuff I had to put up with. And he listened for a while, but then he said, yeah, Rob, he said, that's all true. But he said, in the final analysis, he said, you get paid pretty well to work on things that you think are important. And that's not all bad. And I think that's another, probably a good piece of advice, which is, focus on what's good. Because he's absolutely right. How many people in the world get to prioritize what they think is the most important thing to work on? And get paid fairly handsomely for it, right? So,
yeah. Okay, those are good. And my final question is, what advice would you give your younger self?
What advice would I give my younger self? I think I might say to my younger self, I might say, don't be quite as quick to move on. And I might say, one of the things I've wondered, and, we talked before about, do you press on in a situation that's difficult, or do you move on to another opportunity? And the only thing I really wonder as I look back over my career is if there are moments when I've moved on, rather when maybe things might have been more interesting if I'd pressed on. And I guess the other thing I might say is be a little more focused, right? I haven't been very focused. I don't really regret it because it's been super interesting and it hasn't really, kind of hurt my ability to, I had a great family. I live comfortably. I can't complain. Right. But I do sometimes think that if I look at the people who have really risen to the very top of achievement, I think they're people who pressed on and pressed on and pressed on, right? And probably through things that were worse than what caused me to move on. Anyway.
Yeah. I think that it's important that we have people that move on and people that press on. And I think sometimes it's nice to find people that have moved on, because sometimes it's really hard to make that decision. I always think because I'm in human resources, and if I have to exit someone, and we treat them with dignity, all those things that are so important. But I also think that on some level, we don't exit people unless there's a reason to exit people. And for their sake, they're going to move on to something that makes them look back and say, I'm glad I got to move on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think generally it does work out. I mean, what I remember saying to one of my kids is, a decision is not right or wrong. You make it right or wrong by whatever you do next, right? By whatever you do after that. But, the other thing I wonder too is, I've been very, very fortunate that I've always had options for moving on. So I don't think, I think sometimes people prevail in a situation and are, truly heroic when they don't really have any other option, yeah, right? They have to press on because they don't have a way of moving on, right? And fortunately or unfortunately, I've always been, kind of lucky enough to have another way to go.
Yeah, that is so true, that sometimes you have to press on no matter what. That's a really relevant point. Those are the questions I have for you. Is there something that you'd like to say to wrap up? Is there something that I should have, asked you? And
yeah, I can't think of anything. I mean, I do, I would really push on this point that you raised earlier. I think the world is getting more interesting. It's getting more diverse. I do believe that the world kind of needs all the talent it can get. We have some pretty substantial challenges ahead of us. And I firmly believe that, the answer to those challenges is going to come out of tapping as much talent from as many people and as many different kinds of people and different kinds of ideas and thinking as we can get access to, right? And so we really have to challenge ourselves to be open to difference, open to new ideas and so forth. I think there's a big chunk of the world right now that's a little overwhelmed by all of that. And their reaction is to pull back and to try to protect and return to the old. Maybe this is kind of a balance that's always been with us, but I really hope people will choose adventure and choose, you know, to rise to the challenge rather than to pull back within themselves and try to, you know, keep everything that they have.
And, you know, I like the idea of, you know, accepting people who are left-handed and not trying to make them right-handed, right?
Yeah, I think that's huge. Yeah, really, really important that we're all different and, you know, it's all okay. It's not all equally optimized for moving through the world, but that's okay. We can do something about that now, too. And that's the other thing I'd say is technology has come to a place where we are more capable than we've ever been to deal with those kinds of issues, right? We can personalize, we can solve problems of that nature that we weren't necessarily able to 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Rob, thanks so much for chatting with me today. I really, really appreciate this.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure. I don't really have very much time, or I don't have many opportunities to sit back and talk about things like this. So it's interesting.
To our viewers and listeners, thank you so much for joining Rob and me today. Really interesting stuff. It really makes you think about neurodiversity and how we all bring something special to the table. If you're a listener, follow me on wherever you get your podcasts. If you're a viewer, take a look at YouTube. Please subscribe if you could. And please feel free to visit my website, career-resilience.com, where you'll find all my segments. So thanks again until we meet again.